Good morning. Good morning, Germany. Good morning, Berlin. So I can't tell you how excited I am to be a developer. I love being a developer. I love working on the technologies to help IT pros. And what we're going to do today is we're going to spend some time talking about some of the great new things coming out of the platform and thinking about how we can solve some of the most challenging problems that face both developers and IT pros in the industry today. So let's get right into it. I think there's my clicker. And think about this. Back in 2008, we hit this really interesting point. The number of devices is equal to the world population, and that just continues to explode. We're at this really very interesting point in the industry where hardware is no longer the blocker for what a lot of people want to do. It's becoming increasingly inexpensive. Devices that in the past would have cost thousands of dollars are now sitting on people's wrists. They're sitting in stores at less than 100 euros, less than $100. Phones with incredible processing capabilities that are available for under 50 euros. Now, as we kind of think about this, and you think about that combination of users, of devices, of all of those apps and all of that data, we're pushing the envelope in terms of scale beyond anything that's ever been done. And all of us, as an industry, start to look at this and we think about how are we going to tackle that next round of challenges. Now, there's something that's been pretty incredible that's been happening in the industry, and that's the cloud. Now, people look at this cloud and they think, oh, that's just about hosting some of my data off-site. Not really. The cloud represents a discontinuity in the architectures of the software that we build. We're able to do things using cloud fabrics, cloud technologies that just would have been impossible. If you go back and you think about when Google introduced a gigabyte of email storage, it was beyond what anyone else has done. And now, today, we offer unlimited storage to people using Office 365 accounts. That's all been made possible by the advances that are occurring in these cloud architectures. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about how these platforms and productivity come together, and we'll focus initially on thinking about how this works in the space of the cloud. So let's drill in on the cloud. When we think about the cloud, we think about three big pillars. We think about this ability to take your existing work and keep going. We're not trying to say, hey, you need to move everything to the cloud. In fact, we recognize that most companies, most developers, most IT pros have lots of existing assets that they want to keep running, whether it's inside their premises, on their PCs at home, whatever it happens to be. So hybrid for us remains a very, very important part of the program, and we think we're one of the few differentiated players out there. But then what we do is we combine the ability to take what you have already, and we combine it with hyperscale, and then we bring enterprise-grade capabilities to that. So let's talk about hybrid for a minute. You think about the challenges that people face as this new cloud is emerging. There's all kinds of complexity that's arising. How am I going to move my data back and forth? I have issues about data sovereignty and privacy. I have issues about how do I manage applications as those applications start to move into the cloud? How do I handle the new set of users that are occurring on devices like iPads or Android devices? To help you, one of the things that Microsoft has been working very hard over the last number of years is to produce a consistent platform across what we do in our data, in your data centers, in the cloud, but also enabling third parties to produce those same kind of technologies. And we're being consistent across many aspects of the platform, whether it's management, virtualization, identity, networking, data, the development, a common set of tools allowing us to work across all of those pieces. Now, that ends up being a pretty big deal in many cases. So you think about, for example, the ability to take your existing data and connect it up to Azure. So we're taking advantage of those advances in the cloud to do things like storage and backup at much, much lower costs than people have ever had with enterprise-based solutions. We're adding new kinds of capabilities such as failover. So think about the challenge that someone might face, a small company, they only have one data center, and then they want to be able to have disaster recovery in case that data center goes down. We make it easy to flip your application to run in the cloud, flip it back, move the locus of control back and forth. Things like identity start to move up into the application stack. We've taken Active Directory, which is one of the leading identity solutions inside companies, and we've projected that up to the cloud for things like Office 365 or for your applications. We'll show doing some more of that moving forward. Networking, big deal. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Operational insights. Imagine a single pane of glass, that Azure portal being able to look across all of your all of the things that you manage from an IT perspective, as well as the mobile devices and the things in the cloud, all integrated into one single portal that you can get to from anywhere. That's where we're headed. Lastly, IoT, particularly here in Germany, we see a ton of projects. We work with top car manufacturers. We work with a lot of folks who want to take the technologies in the cloud, they want to take the technologies that they have on premise, and they want to start bringing them together. So let me just do a quick overview of a fantastic piece of technology we just announced called Azure Event Hubs. Azure Event Hubs are an extension of our service bus technology that allow for high-speed data ingestion from devices no matter where they occur. They could be on the factory floor, they could be mobile devices that are workers, they could be thermostats and hot water heaters in your home. All of these devices are sending data out, and we want to collect that up. And many people face this challenge of, wow, there's a lot of data. There's millions upon millions of these devices. How do we do that, and how do we handle the data rates? So one of the great things about Azure Event Hubs is it can handle a gigabyte per second of data ingestion across 2 million devices per hub. And if you need more, just add hubs. Totally horizontally scalable, massive ingestion capabilities, very low cost. So to help illustrate that, what I wanted to do is I wanted to invite Josh Holmes on my team. We've been working with a lot of companies, like I said, here in Germany, and other places where we've been pulling together some of these solutions. So Josh, what do you have for us?
Well, so first what I want to do is start out with how crazy, crazy simple it is to connect to Event Hubs and show you just a little bit of code. Can we get these PCs up? Should be number two. How do we switch to here?
There. Nope.
Oh, there we are. Getting there? That's a later demo. Where is number two? Oh. Thank you. There we are.
There
okay,
we go.
Fantastic. So, yay, congratulations, awesome. So, first thing I want to do is show you how crazy simple it is to connect to Azure Event Hubs. So, first thing you do is you make sure that the Event Hub is there, and there's this wonderful thing called Create Event Hub If Not Exist Async. It's a mouthful, it's almost a German word, and but what it does is it goes out and it provisions the Event Hub for you and you're ready to go. And then this is literally the rest of the code that you need in order to send an event into Event Hub. Just you do this a million times. So you're going to take a string, you're going to create it, a binary out of that, and then here we're going to create the message factory. You can add lots of properties to it, so for your filtering and sorting. You grab your client and then you call send async. And you're done.
And that's in .NET.
That's in .NET, But you can also do this in, and this is also using AMQP.
Yep.
So AMQP is the primary protocol for event hubs and service bus, but you can also use REST. And so I've used REST from Node.js, from Python, from Ruby, from a number of different technologies to push into event hubs very
simply. So that's getting the data out. Now, how do we look at the data?
So how we look at the data is very, very simple as well. So we're going to create another event hub client, and this one we're going to create a consumer group. And a consumer group is, we can have as many consumer groups as we want, and each one of them maintains their own bookmark, so to speak, in the data stream. And we'll see that in just a minute as to how we set that bookmark. But then, you know, so you could have one for real-time processing, one for cold storage, et cetera. We're going to register event processor async, and we're going to tell it this class here handles that. And then when we disconnect, we want to unregister and say, hey, we're no longer here, we're no longer listening. So let's go look at this real quickly. We'll go to definition of this. And so we open up the partition, and then we're going to process this event asynchronously. And what that does is every time there's a batch of messages, it gives us a list. We loop through those. We do what we want to do. And then for this demo, we decided every 5 minutes, we're going to set a checkpoint. And that checkpoint says, next time I start reading, I want to start here. Okay? And so that way, we're only 5 minutes behind at worst any given point in time. So that's it. I mean, that is literally all of the code that you need in order to scale so massively.
Yeah, now what's interesting about this is they're building systems like this in the past have been very difficult for people. In fact, there's teams at Microsoft who have tried to go build scale-out systems to monitor all these events and have really struggled to get large number of events in process. The beautiful thing that we've got here is a horizontally scalable system, super easy programming model, and the cloud is helping the developers just take care of this. In fact, I think you got a demo that we can show that we've been using with a lot of companies that we work with.
So green energy, clean energy, love this. Solar panels, and we're producing across 10 different fields, and 2,000 devices per field. Start adding all this up, 200,000 devices, pushing roughly 750,000 messages per second into event hubs, and we're able to see the aggregates and you know all the flowing items there. So then we can dip into an individual field. Okay, and we can actually see each of the individual panels. And then we can click into an individual panel here. And so this one is actually here in the building. It's actually right here.
There.
And so this one, if I block the light from it for a second, there we are. And let go. There we are. And so that is connecting to my event hub that is actually in Western US and coming back with that latency. So incredibly massive scale and works great. And then we can actually, using Service Bus, in addition, we can actually reach down and control the individual device. And so normally this will orientate to the brightest light, but I can set a command here and send it as well. So that's what I got.
Great. Thank you, Josh. So this is just one small example of how we're taking those cloud technologies and we're using it to solve problems that people have very much struggled with in the past. And this has become a very exciting area for many applications. So now let's kind of push ahead a little bit and think about this notion of the cloud. And one of the questions I often get is, boy, Microsoft, it seems like you're pushing us to do more and more in the cloud. And what I would say is, we need to separate two things. We're not just saying cloud, in other words, put your data up with us. We're saying cloud as an architecture is the new way to build things at incredible scale at very low price. So one of the first things that we've done to help not drive you to use our public cloud is we've introduced the Azure Pack. What the Azure Pack allows you to do is it allows you to take all that goodness of the cloud and bring it down to the machines running inside your data center. So you can take this, you pop it on your machines, and now suddenly you've got a pool of virtual machines, you've got the storage capabilities, you've got the service bus, all running on your own hardware inside your organization, and you can use that to help you build and manage your applications. We've also gone a step further. We just announced the new cloud platform system. And this is a pretty exciting thing. We've partnered with hardware vendors, starting with Dell, where you can go and you can order Azure in a box. They will literally ship you a gigantic rack, which you drop down and plug in, connect it to the cloud, and now it's a fully managed Azure cloud on your premises. So we're bringing that ability to take that cloud architecture and use it everywhere. So this has been one of the more exciting opportunities for companies, particularly when they worry about things like privacy or data sovereignty. For example, in Germany, there's very strict rules about the ability to move data in and out. So this has become a pretty important part of many of the solutions that we're working on. Now, here's the other interesting part about this. Lots of third parties are also taking advantage of this. So we're providing this capability so that there are literally hundreds, we're working toward thousands of companies that are taking these technologies and offering their clouds to their partners. And it's not just clouds. We're also offering great capabilities around networking and so on. So a big piece of making these new systems work is the ability to connect together these systems through networking. And one of the things that we've noticed time and time again is people have built applications that leverage other data centers, leverage other cloud data centers that we provide or the third parties provide, is that network latency, network connectivity over the open internet is often quite problematic. We'll know, for example, that the data center is up and running, and yet the customers who are trying to run that application connected into their data center can't connect to the data center, not because the data center's down, but because the internet's not working quite the way you want it to. So we've partnered with the telecom communication companies around the world to bring a new capability called ExpressRoute. This is a very unique offering in the industry. It offers extremely high performance, very low latency connectivity between your data centers and the cloud, ensuring that you've got the connectivity and the capability to get your job done. We offer a high degree of SLA, and we offer enterprise-grade reliability across this. This has become critical for many new kinds of applications where we've done things like take large existing databases that are on-premise and connect them up to cloud processing. So I want to now talk a little bit about hyperscale. So what we just talked about is this ability to mix and match. Well, it's also important that when we're building something in the cloud, we can extend the capabilities in terms of performance, throughput, overall bandwidth into the applications. So we've got 19 data centers around the world, but as I mentioned, we've got hundreds of partners that are also building out data centers based on that same cloud technology. And over the last 12 months, the amount of work that's been going on inside of Azure to introduce capabilities on top of this emerging cloud platform is unprecedented. The rate of change in these cloud architectures is way beyond anything that we've ever been able to do with packaged software. So we're really excited as developers about our ability to get new features out to folks. Multi-factor auth, I mean, it just kind of goes on and on about the new things that we end up producing. So I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about some of those key innovations. One that has been exciting to so many companies that I work with is the new G family of computational capability. A lot of times when people think about the cloud, they only think about horizontal scaling, that will just bring more and more machines to help solve the problem. But there are some workloads where more machines doesn't necessarily help you. What you want is a one machine that's an awful lot faster. So this new G family is optimized for data workloads. This uses the absolute latest Intel chips, up to 32 CPU cores running simultaneously, about a half a terabyte of RAM, and over 6 terabytes of SSD with incredibly high performance. People are using these things for all kinds of interesting workloads. Analytics workloads, genomics. This lets people take existing software, bring it up there, and run these things in the cloud. And there is no faster, more powerful machine available from any cloud provider. Now, that's great. You got this fast machine. But there's this other issue, which is, what are we going to do with the results? So we're also very excited to announce this week that we have the new premium storage offering. This offers up to 32 terabytes of storage per VM, but here's the thing. The number of IOPS we're able to do this thing exceeds anything offered in the industry today. About the fastest you can get out of any system today is about 48,000 IOPS out of the Amazon offering. But I thought it'd be interesting to kind of show us pushing the envelope here. We guarantee actually more than 50,000 IOPS with less than 1 millisecond range. So Hashi, why don't you come on up and let's show how far we can push this system. All right.
Okay, let me start my virtual machines. Is it connected to this? So here I'm going to show you three virtual machines. The first one, just for comparison, I have our A-series machine. This is an 8-core virtual machine with 56 gigs of memory, and I have a 1 terabyte data disk attached to it. I'm going to run Alameter on it, which is a disk performance tool made by Intel. I'll just start the test. You can see on this machine, I'm getting about 500 IOPS per second, which is expected for the standard storage. But now I'm going to run the same test on the D-series machine. This is a D-series D14, has 16 cores, 112 gigs of memory. It's a wonderful machine with 1 terabyte of data disk attached. And I'm going to run the same test. And you can see on this one with single disk, single virtual machine, I can get 4,000 IOPS per second. But we want to see the real number, right? We want to see the over 50,000 IOPS. So this is what we are going to do. This is a D14 machine again, but in this case, I have 16 1 terabyte disks attached, and they are strapped into one data volume, and I'm going to run the same test. Watch this. We're not lying. This is well over 50,000 IOPS per second. And this is the fastest you can get from any cloud platform.
So we're pretty excited. And obviously, you know, this is the beginning of where we're starting with the new offering. We expect this to accelerate over time. So this is really exciting. If you think about where we're going with the cloud, I talked about these cloud architectures pushing the envelope beyond what people have been able to do today. We're making these things available in a turnkey way, as simple as going into your VM, selecting the storage account that has it configured to be able to go do this. No work for you as an IT pro to go get this other than managing the subscriptions and so on. All right, let's switch gears again, and let's talk a little bit about processing. So we just talked about kind of the raw material of CPU, disk, making sure that we've got the RAM out there. And that's a great way to go build applications. The cloud also has brought a new way to build applications, which is, could I just create very, very large workloads and hand them off to the cloud for processing on the cheap? When there's not cycles to be used up in the cloud, why don't we do lots of computation? There's many workloads that look like this. We're working with one of the largest insurance companies, and they do actuarial models. And they need to run those things and turn them around much faster than they were ever able to before. It used to take them literally a month or two to get through their models. With Azure, we've been able to run an incredible number of batch roles, hundreds of thousands of them. And they're able to take that actuarial processing down to literally minutes. Changes the nature of their business. So what Hashi's going to show us is how easy it is to put together one of these Azure batch processing capabilities, and then we'll look at something fun.
Yep. So here, what I'm showing is actually a Hello World program for Azure Batch. We have an Azure Batch SDK, which is a NuGet package. You just search for azure.batch. You can download it today. And first, I'm going to show you the actual processing program. This is a console application. You can see in this program, actually, I made no reference to Azure Batch whatsoever. This is just a regular console application. I'm downloading a text file using the web client. Then I'm using a link query to calculate the word frequency in that text file. Then I'm simply outputting my result to my console output. I didn't write to any storage or database. I just say console write line. So that's all I need to do. And here I have another program, which is where you interact with Azure Batch. After you get the NuGet package, it's the typical way how you communicate with any Azure services. First, you get a credential for the service. Then you create a client, which gives you all the functionality you need to interact with the service. Then the next thing is interesting. I'm going to allocate a resource pool. This is the virtual machine I want Azure to give me. Here I'm only using three small machines, but you can go up to thousands of large machines if you want. And once I have the machines, I can define my work item, which got translated into a job. And once I have the job object, I can start to add tasks to it. And in this case, if you throw down the code, you can see all I'm doing is to call a command line, call the executable, and give it a parameter to run the program. Then I'm going to wait for the task to finish, then just print the output of the task. So this is really easy, really straightforward to do. And especially when you're writing the processing program, you don't need to know anything about Azure. You just focus on the algorithm itself, then you can do wonderful things.
Yeah. Now, counting words, that's kind of interesting. So one of the things that I asked Hachi to do was, could we show off Azure Batch in a way that's a little more interesting?
Yeah.
So what do you got for us?
Yeah, definitely. So here I have Blender, which is a really popular open source 3D modeling and rendering program. And I have a model loaded here. It doesn't look very exciting here, but actually, this is a very challenging scene to be rendered. It has a lot of transparent materials, a lot of lighting sources, lighting effects. Actually, if I launch this one, actually, I'm going to kick it off. I will render the image locally. What I got here is a good machine. This is an 8-core Lenovo machine. But this scene will take about a couple hours to render. I think we should just wait, right?
You want to wait? Yeah. We'll hang out here. Now, there's got to be a better way. We're talking about Azure Batch. What can we do instead?
Yeah, so if I zoom in here, you can see we actually have a Blender plugin for Azure Batch. What I can do is to submit the same rendering job to Azure Batch directly from this plugin. So if I click on the submit job, and all I need to do is to click on the submit job button to submit the job. But before I move forward, I want to point you out, here I'm saying I want 37 virtual machines. These are 8-core virtual machines, so I'm literally using 300 cores for this rendering. I'm rendering a full HD image in this case using ray tracing. It's a very complex rendering. So I'm going to return home. And here in the plugin, we also have a simple UI for you to manage your job. You can see this is the job I just submitted. And if you open, it's kind of getting ready to be processed. But if you want more complex control, you can actually, you can actually go to the batch portal. Actually, let me zoom out. This is too big. You can go to our new batch apps portal. You can monitor all the job execution, and you can diagnostic problems if you have any problem. If I zoom into this job, you can see all my 36 virtual machines running. Each one is rendering one of the tiles. And what's amazing about this portal is that if you have some problems, you can actually click into the job logs. These are aggregated logs from all the virtual machines. This is just not one virtual machine. You can actually see the logs from the entire cluster. I'm going to close this one. And you can see now all the tiles have been rendered. And I'm kicking off the last job, which is to stitch all the tiles into a complete image. And now this one is finished as well. I'm going to click on job output and get a rendered image. Ready for this? This is a beautiful image rendered in a few seconds. And if you go back to Blender, it's still working on it. Actually, I need to stop this because it's using all my CPUs.
All right, thanks. Thank you. Awesome. So I think this helps illustrate just how much the cloud is really changing the economics and the accessibility of hardware. I mean, projects, issues that we've faced historically on-premise when developers have tried to create applications, that ability to procure, configure, and run the hardware is often pretty insurmountable, particularly as you start looking at thousands of machines. As you just saw, our ability to just go spin up hundreds, thousands of machines is almost trivial now. And this kind of programming is becoming increasingly the norm. So let's now push ahead a little bit more and talk a little bit about the work we've been doing with open source. Now, I think a lot of people, when they think about Azure, they think about the old world of Windows Azure. And Windows Azure was about running Windows servers and Windows capabilities up in the cloud. But one of the things that's happened over the last several years is we've made a huge change in the underlying architecture of our cloud platform to be completely open with respect to the VM technologies, the open source middleware, and so on, so much so that we ultimately decided to rename it to Microsoft Azure to reflect that. And as I think you probably know, very significant numbers of workloads are now running up on Azure that have nothing to do with Windows. They're Linux-based, they're Drupal-based, they're Docker-based. So we have all of these things running, they're available in the store. We have many partners who are increasingly excited about Azure as the platform for both Microsoft and Linux Android-based solutions. We'll show a little bit more about that. Now, in the past, when Microsoft bought a company, we often said, hey, that's a really nice piece of software, but you happen to be running on Linux. Why don't you put that on Windows Server, and then we'll go put it up in our cloud, and we would often make companies rewrite their software. That's not true anymore. Now, when we acquire companies like Skype or whatever it happens to be, we love having workloads that are not Windows workloads. So we recently completed an acquisition this week, a pretty fun one. And so just to kind of illustrate how far we've pushed ahead with some technologies like Docker, like CoreOS, I thought we should run one of the most popular pieces of Java software that's in the industry today. Does anybody know what maybe the most popular piece of Java software is? Minecraft. All right, let's do it.
All right. So we're back to the machine. I'm going to launch the Docker client for Windows. This is the early build for the Docker client for Windows. This is the native Windows application. You can use all the Docker commands against your Azure virtual machines and manage your Docker containers on it. So before we show the Minecraft, I will show some other commands. The first one I'm going to show is that I can actually use this client to directly provision Azure virtual machine and have Docker Engine installed and configured and ready to go. In this case, I'm creating a new virtual machine using the CoreOS image. We are adding in the Docker in the Azure gallery. And just one command, I can get the virtual machine running. The second command I'm going to show is the Docker hosts command. This command lists all the Docker hosts that I'm managing from this client. This command takes a little while because it needs to contact all the servers and to check the health status. And you can see here I'm connected to actually three Azure virtual machines. And I'm going to launch Ubuntu virtual machine on the CoreOS virtual machine. Let's see how long it will take. I press enter, and it takes about 2-3 seconds. And now I actually have a new Ubuntu machine on my CoreOS machine on Azure. So actually, I can use all the Linux commands. In this case, if I list the processes, you can see, although the virtual machine may have other processes running, because the container isolation, I only see the process running in this container.
And that ability to run workloads in containers really changes the economics of putting some application out in the cloud. You don't have to spin up a virtual machine per. You can have many applications running within a given machine.
Yeah, you have incredible compute density. So on one virtual machine, you can spin up thousands of containers, if you will. So let me exit out from this container. Actually, I'm going to switch to my Ubuntu host. And here's the moment I've been waiting for as well, to launch the Minecraft server. Actually, all I need to do is to go to the Docker Hub to download the Minecraft image and to launch it. This is the good thing about the Docker Hub. It's a wonderful community, most popular software and services. You can just go to Docker Hub and download the image and get running. So I'm ready to press Enter. And there you go. I have a Minecraft server running.
So literally that easy to take that code that's out in the Docker Hub and get it running on Azure. I mean, literally seconds to start one of these things up. Now we can play on this thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of the day. I'm just playing this.
Sounds good.
So I'm going to launch the Minecraft client for Windows.
Also Java?
Yeah, all the server and the clients are all Java. So I'm going to select multiplayer, connect to my server. You can see this is my DNS name on Azure. I can actually invite all my friends across the globe to play on this server with me. I'm trying to join the server. Let's hope the network is working. We don't have express route on this machine, but we'll see it will
there
work.
There you go.
So now I have Minecraft. You can see it's running. It's run smoothly. I can just play on the container.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now look, obviously Minecraft's a game, but the point here is we've taken all of this technology that has been growing up in the open source world, and it's now just part and parcel of Azure as well. So if you've got technologies that you use inside your organization, whether it's Windows technology or open source technology, we love those, and we're embracing them, and we're accelerating our ability and the simplicity with which people can put those together. All right, so I wanted to kind of move ahead here a little bit, and let's talk about enterprise grade. It's interesting, Gartner came out with a set of reports, talking about various aspects of the cloud and where companies are going. And Microsoft is the only company across all of those dimensions that was in the upper right-hand quadrant. So we were top in virtualization, top in public cloud storage, top in cloud infrastructure as a service, and top in application platform for enterprise apps. And I think this is really kind of telling, because if you think about the set of partners that have joined in with Microsoft, it's companies that you wouldn't expect to be great Microsoft partners. Oracle, for example, when they were looking for a cloud vendor, chose Microsoft. IBM, when they were looking for a cloud vendor, chose Microsoft. And it all has to do with the ability to pull together this open platform with the characteristics that people are looking for in enterprise apps. That includes the SLAs. That includes the policy management. If you step back even further and you start thinking about the set of companies in the world that are able to run data centers around the world at incredible scale, there are just a couple. Amazon's doing it, Google's doing it, Microsoft's doing it. Those are general purpose cloud platforms at incredible scale, and in each case, we have major workloads of our own that we run on top of that. Google with search, Microsoft with search and Office 365, Amazon with their retail presence. There just aren't a lot of companies that are able to achieve that scale. At the same time, if you look at the set of companies that are out there that are truly producing the set of technologies that companies need to run their enterprises, whether it's the hybrid capabilities, whether it's the ability to manage things like workflows, we're also a leader in that space. And then when you look at the intersection of those two companies, there's almost no one left. Microsoft is the only player across all of these areas where we're making the level of investment in both enterprise and in cloud. So we're pretty excited about our work in this space. We continue to double down on our ability to empower partners, our ability to empower countries, our ability to empower organizations to go build the next generation apps that take advantage of all of what we've just seen. Now, let's just think about the set of enterprise technologies that we've got to offer. And I think people in general know about many of the pieces. At the topmost level, Office 365 and technologies like Active Directory are the leading solutions inside of most organizations for enterprise productivity. The combination of these things coming together is where most companies have invested a lot of effort in maintaining their internal infrastructure. But as we've seen, the number of devices out in the world has continued to proliferate. Android devices, iOS devices, Windows devices, the growth rates across these platforms are incredible. So we were very excited this week to announce that we're taking all of the technologies here, including our ability to manage those devices, and we're accelerating our work across all the platforms. So we announced new versions of our enterprise office suite on iPads and iOS, iPhones. We have new Android applications on the way, and so we're making this available to everyone, and we're reducing those barriers. In fact, we're going so far as to even remove the limitations that individuals have had in terms of editing, so that you download this stuff and anybody can go use these things. So this kind of brings together the set of things that we've been doing in enterprise productivity, and it illustrates where we're headed in the device space. We believe in a multi-device world. We don't think that there's going to be a singularity around Windows or a singularity around iPhone or a singularity around Android. We think that they're all going to exist, and we think people should be able to choose. And so to help illustrate that, what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk a little bit more about our device strategy, and let's start with, come on up, Neil. Let's talk a little bit about what we've just talked about. We've GA'd these new versions of the Office 365 APIs, but what's really interesting is that we're also making this all available to developers on all these different platforms. And so that's what Neil's going to walk us through. Ready to go?
Hopefully. So we move over. So as John was saying, we already have this concept of applications and being able to extend Office. But what we now have is an SDK for Android, iOS, and obviously for .NET. That allows you to connect to those services at the back end. So what I have here is an application that's available for you as a sample through GitHub that shows you literally how to actually make that connection to your Office 365 service. So first of all, I'm going to run the application. And so the first thing that's going to happen here is, you know, this whole infrastructure is connected through Active Directory, and we're connecting to the Active Directory authentication library.
So that's pretty interesting. Here's someone's personal app running on, in this case, on Mac OS in the emulator, connecting to Active Directory through this SDK. So he's going to log in. Get your password right. Nicely done.
And no one saw that. So this application is very simple, and we're basically going to go and play with my calendar, and we're going to look for calendar entries.
Yeah. So while that comes, the code here.
While that comes back, so basically the code is pretty simple. This is obviously Java code for Android. We use a similar kind of pattern. We have this Outlook client object. First of all, we're actually going to link to the folder which I have as my user. I'm going to get the calendar objects, and then I'm going to actually read the first one. That whole function is asynchronous. If it's successful, I'm then going to do a quick sort and sort the items in order. And then once that's complete, I'm then going to call into, obviously, my view and actually start entering the calendar entries items into the view. So we go back to the application. As you can see, we're running out of time, but here's my first entry that's pulled directly from my Outlook calendar.
Great. Thank you very much. So that's just a quick sample of what we're doing out in the events in the programming space for Android. Let's now talk a little bit about what we're doing on our platform. Over the last several years, we've made a huge effort to start bringing together the set of technologies around our devices. We brought together the common kernel into Xbox and into the phone and into the tablet. But we weren't yet ready until this next round of Windows to make it one common platform. And what we're very excited about is the next round of Windows in Windows 10, where there will be a single dev experience across all these devices. Your ability to go create a universal app that runs on everything from the phone up to the largest devices in the house, that's where we're headed. Now, that converged application platform we think is a pretty big deal in a lot of different ways. If you think about, as a developer, using Windows 8 to produce your applications, it was a tough road. You would go build these applications, people struggled to find them, people struggled to purchase them in the store, the stores were different, so if they purchased on the tablet, that wasn't the same as the phone, and all of that meant that as a developer, there was lost opportunity. Every time you would go build an app, your ability to go monetize and to get that out to a lot of people, you hit barrier after barrier. So we've really focused in this next round around bringing that all together. We've also focused on making sure that the end user experience associated with finding, launching, and using applications is way, way better than it was on the previous two releases of the operating system. So with that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have Neil walk us through a couple of the key changes in Windows that are helping developers really take advantage of the platform in terms of their ability to monetize, but also even use the platform. And then we'll talk a little bit more about where we're headed with our ability to make it easy to test and run. So, we good to go?
We're going. Okay. So the first thing, if we move to back to number one. So here is Windows 10. So this, you know, as John was saying, we wanted to bring both worlds together and enable people who build for the new experience and also people who build for the desktop to have that common environment. So obviously one of the biggest changes we've made here is in the start screen. So basically it's now natural to see both the new modern applications and also desktop applications in the same view. Obviously, this is a modern application, but as you notice at the very top, we have the ability to minimize, so we can actually have all these applications running as windows with inside the machine. I can also simply go in and say, let's say, bring up the control panel if I'm an IT pro. Place it, and again, drag that onto the screen, and here we have literally both a modern application and an existing desktop application running side by side. From a start screen perspective, obviously, I have that full ability to customize as well, so here I'm going to resize my screen and resize all my tiles, make it wide, I can move it around, I can adjust the height of my screen as well. You know, I have that full fidelity.
Now, as a developer, one of the key things is just the ability to use the start menu. As new apps get added to the machine after they're purchased in the store, it was very difficult for users to find them. Now we can navigate through just as people did and drag them over to the start screen and start using them.
Yeah.
And as Neil described, the other big change is this ability to take the modern apps and run them in Windows. I mean, that might seem kind of crazy. People joke that sometimes Windows 8 should have been called Windows 8. But we really think of this ability to have multiple overlapping windows with the modern apps and the Win32 as key to enabling people to take advantage of the new capabilities in the operating system. Now, we've also got some stuff around developer productivity in the command line.
So the other thing is, one of the other things we did with Windows 10 was say, hey, we know we have these power users who know about all these special shortcuts. Let's try and make it really easy for them, for other people, just general users, to be able to navigate. So one of the things we also created is this concept of multiple desktops with an environment. So as you can see, I can now navigate between different desktops, maybe one for my personal life and one for my work life. And here we see this is Joe demonstrating Windows 10. But here is also the command line. And so one of the big things we also did, which I think got huge acclaim for some strange reason, was we actually provided cut and paste with inside the command line. So you know, as a developer, as an IT pro, being able to copy and paste commands, you know, was kind of a pain in the past, and you had to sort of do this.
Well, it's the combo of all of the shortcut keys. So you don't have to lift your hand off the keyboard to navigate around, to do all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Now,
so one of the interesting things, and this is going to be a little harder on the screen, and I wanted to place this on the Mac, but the
network, I'll hold it.
Network's not playing good with me at the moment. Not going to work. So obviously, as a developer, if you're building browser applications, and if you're developing using, a Mac or a non-Windows device, it's sometimes really, really hard to make sure we get the exact same user fidelity on, say, Chrome, Firefox, and also IE. So what we announced last week was a program called Remote IE. And what this allows you to do is run the IE, different versions of IE, through non-Windows devices. So here is IE actually running on an Android device. It runs perfectly well on a Mac as well, an iPad, whatever device you have. And also, you have the ability to run different versions of IE as well. So if you want to test it on different versions to make sure you have that great fidelity for your users, we can do that.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this isn't IE running natively on the Mac. What we're doing is we're leveraging the cloud as a test platform and then projecting IE to all of these different devices for purposes of testing. And as we move forward, we'll continue to make this more automatable and so on. Great.
Okay.
So let's wrap up here. So what we tried to do this morning is give you a quick overview of how the platforms, both the cloud and the device platform, are making it so that developers and information workers can be more productive. We think about the role that we have as a partner here, and we're looking to help you be successful. And we want to thank all of you for the work that you're doing to help make this platform successful. As we move forward, there's a couple of things that we're excited about. Azure is out there. There's free trials. We'd like you to do that. We'd like you to join the Windows 10 Insiders program, take a look at that new technology. But where we really get excited is we'd like you to come code with us. So for example, tomorrow we talked about the Event Hub as that very first demo. We have a whole Hackfest going on all day. We'll be using these cool little boards, and we're going to use Event Hub and all the technologies that you saw to go put together some apps. And so my team will be here. There's a bunch of us here. We find that just getting your hands dirty, writing the code, there's no better way to get up to speed on some of these new things. We also have all the Virtual Academy work that's out there as good ways to go learn about this stuff, and we're excited about that too. So with that, I think I have about 3 minutes, or I can take a few questions, and I'll let the team tell me when we need to go. And I know that there's mics out there in case people want to ask. So do we have questions? I answered all of them. Anyone? We have one.
Yeah, there's one.
All right. Great. Oops.
So for the nice rendered image, what was the cost? What was the cost to do this?
Hashi, do you know the cost offhand?
I turned off my mic, but I was being really loud. Because we have the permitted...
Just wait. It should work.
It should work.
Is it not on?
We have another... Here we have...
Oh, there you go.
This one works? Okay. So because we have the permitted charging for Azure VM, so actually you're literally incurring the cost of actual compute hours that you're using. But to be frank, that there is some setup and teardown time that will occur. So that's why it makes more sense to run a larger load that will this teardown and the setup is a small portion of the overall time. But essentially, you're just paying what's you're accruing on the compute hours.
Yeah, so in this case, about 2 minutes of compute time for that one?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
Yeah, so hopefully that answers the question, which is the great thing about batch is you're using both low cost and very small amounts associated with whatever it is you're doing. Okay? Any others? And then we'll move on to the next. All right, thank you very much, and have a good day. Hope to see you tomorrow.